Welcome to today's edition of Bob's Radio Journal Podcast.
Hi, folks. How are you? This is Bob Anderson coming to you from the beautiful Laurel Highlands here in Pennsylvania. You're connected to Bob's Radio Journal Podcast, bringing you clean, uplifting entertainment, news, and talk. Every school child in America knows why we celebrate the 4th of July. Flags and fireworks commemorate the day we declared our independence from Britain. On July 4th, 1776, after months of heated debate, representatives of the Continental Congress voted unanimously that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. 13 colonies voted to become something new in history, the United States of America. Now all they had to do was win their independence from a government that would consider them traitors. 56 men bravely affixed their signatures to the Declaration of Independence. What sort of men were they? And what became of them? 24 were lawyers and jurists, 11 were merchants, 9 were farmers or plantation owners. They were well-educated men of means. All of them had a great deal to lose when they voted to defy what was then the most powerful nation on earth. Yet, they willingly risk everything when they pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. As I said, all of us can explain why we celebrate Independence Day on July 4th. But how many of us can name even a handful of the signers of the Declaration of Independence? What do we know, really, about the men who risked their lives and everything they owned in the cause of freedom? As citizens, we need to remember that this is a Christian nation, and our very survival rests firmly on this fact. Our Declaration of Independence is the seedbed of Christian principles. In fact, it is the philosophy of our nation. Our United States Constitution is the implementation of the philosophy. Please listen now to the further amplification of these facts. And by the way, happy 4th of July.
You're connected to the Cricket and Seagull Fireside Chat Podcast. This week, the Declaration of Independence, Happy 4th of July, with moments from the lives of two of the signers of the Declaration, with Grant Beckwith. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. Have you ever heard the Bulletproof Washington story? Or known about the spiritual epiphany of young John Adams? If not, you're not alone. They're omitted from nearly all school texts today, even though they once were common knowledge. If you've missed out on those stories like I had, if you've wondered where the idea of separation of church and state came from, or wondered what the writers of the Declaration of Independence really meant when they speak of the God of nature, then you'll enjoy this interview with lawyer and educator Grant Beckwith, currently the principal of American Heritage School in American Fork, Utah. That's this week on The Cricket and Seagull. My guest today is Grant Beckwith, who's the principal of the American Heritage School and Family Education Center, right across the street if you're looking for a landmark from the Mount Timpanogos Temple in American Fork, Utah. We're in Grant's office. Thank you for letting me be here.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Because the 4th of July Independence Day weekend is coming up, this seemed like the perfect place, American Heritage being in the title of the school, and also some of your area of expertise, talking about some of the, I guess, lesser known or even forgotten aspects of 4th of July celebrations and Christian events that used to be taught in school but aren't anymore.
That's right, and I'm thrilled that you asked me to talk about that. It's a topic that I've always been passionate about, and happy to share some things that have always been close to my heart about this particular holiday.
Speaking of the holiday, you mentioned to me that Americans in general used to view the 4th of July, Independence Day, and the Declaration itself in a whole different way that has changed over time. Will you take us back and tell us about that contrast now and then?
John Quincy Adams actually, in a speech, said to the American people that Christmas and the 4th of July were two that shared something in common. And for him, it was the Christian foundation of both of those holidays. Now, today, we don't view the 4th of July as being a religious or moral holiday. It is a civic holiday. But that is the great difference between our view of the Declaration of Independence. So this is John Quincy Adams, not John Adams, the second president, but John Quincy, his son, and the sixth president. And this was 1837, and he was giving a speech at Newburyport. And he asked the crowd, why is it, and I'm reading this straight from his text, it was a 60-page long, you know, speech that he gave on the 4th of July, and he said, why is it that next to the birthday of the Savior of the world, your most joyous and most venerated festival returns on this day, the 4th of July? So this was a rhetorical question to the crowd. And then John Quincy Adams answers this question, and he says, is it not that in the chain of human events, the birthday of the nation is indissolubly linked with the birthday of the Savior? That it forms a leading event in the progress of the gospel dispensation? Is it not that the Declaration of Independence first organized the social compact on the foundation of the Redeemer's mission upon the earth? That it laid the cornerstone of human government upon the first precepts of Christianity? That's John Quincy Adams. And that's the way the 4th of July used to be viewed, because that's the way the Declaration of Independence used to be viewed. As a document that set forth the first principles and the philosophy and the relationship of God to government. And the Declaration of Independence itself is, I believe, a very misunderstood document, unfortunately. It is clearly a statement of our government's moral responsibility, our source as humankind. You know, Jefferson was the draftsman of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. In his initial draft of the Declaration of Independence, he referred to God once, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. However, in committee with Adams and Franklin, two more references were added. So then we have the addition of the Creator. We have the addition of appealing to the supreme judge of our world. That's in the Declaration. And we have the addition of this language, protection of divine providence, which was added by the full committee before it was drafted. I feel so strongly about our country, we as a people, not forgetting that it's the Declaration that contains the philosophy of our government and our foundation. The Constitution implements that philosophy. I just feel so strongly about our understanding that frankly, you know, I'm an attorney. I practiced for 5 years. When the opportunity was presented to me to make a career change and become an educator, you know, this was one of those things that I thought, great, I'll have a voice where I can actually teach and learn more about this miracle that occurred at Philadelphia. The miracle that occurred, of course, the Declaration was not the miracle of Philadelphia. That was the signing of the Constitution. But interestingly, the miracle at Philadelphia included a provision for amendment of the Constitution, right? The Constitution itself contains, as an organic document, the flexibility to be amended. But the Declaration does not. There is no tool within the Declaration that allows for its amendment, because it's the philosophy of our government. And it states those inalienable rights, that we are endowed by a creator God with those inalienable rights, that it's the laws of nature and of nature's God that rule man, and that man can either keep those commandments or break himself over those commandments, right?
Because they're stated as self-evident truths.
Exactly. So Professor Kamiak, who's a professor of law at Pepperdine University, he did a wonderful job at describing how, you know, the issue of slavery is a great example of what was meant when Jefferson drafted this beautiful phrase of the laws of nature and of nature's God in the Declaration. And he said, slavery is one of those things that as much as man tried to legislate, to promote, to talk about, to live as if other men were inferior to them based on their skin color, the laws of nature and of nature's God recognize all men as having inalienable rights, and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness qualify the black man, the white man, to those equal blessings. And so no matter how much man talked about, tried to legislate slavery, it could not make it so. It could not make it true that there were subservient and less equal men. And so the consequences that came with trying to create law and trying to live life contrary to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God were great and led to great strife, civil war, hundreds of thousands of deaths. And the founders who came from a Judeo-Christian ethic background, they of course understood that God through the Judeo-Christian lens and believed, if you read their writings, that it was only Christianity that had produced the greatest government that the world has ever seen that really truly understood liberty. And therefore Christianity was that religion that created the seedbed for this kind of miracle to occur at Philadelphia.
As immigrants come in, and let's just state this theoretically, from all different countries, all different belief systems, still most of them holding to a belief in nature's God, the God who created the world, viewing it through their own lens of their own religion, can the same philosophy that's in that Declaration of Independence still hold if, and again, theoretically, at a certain point, the majority of those who've come in, even as believers in God, are no longer Christians?
The answer to that is no. And I say that with a recognition that there are many who might hear this and think, but America stands for diversity and tolerance and multiculturalism, and the Statue of Liberty stands for bring me your tired, your poor, your worn. And yes, we do stand as an ensign to the nations of a country where people can come from all different races, cultures, faiths, and find liberty. But that liberty was created in the spirit of Paul the Apostle, who said that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And that particular philosophy and understanding of Christ and Christian principles is the philosophical foundation for our government. And to the extent that we try to redefine that, we will be acting contrary to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, and we will see the consequences. And I think we have seen the consequences. Well, let me give you an example of it. I think at a theoretical level, this is sometimes hard for people of different faiths to grasp, but let's talk about separation of church and state for a minute. Thomas Jefferson said those words in a letter to the Danbury Baptists, 1802. This is one of the reasons why I think that we view the Declaration of Independence so differently today than we used to, because there's been a secular shift away from the true and original interpretation of the First Amendment, which of course allows and provides not for the separation of church and state, but for, well, the language of the First Amendment is that Congress shall make no law establishing, right, religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Those are two clauses, the establishment clause and the free exercise clause.
There is no separation clause.
There's no separation clause. So in 1802, Jefferson writes this letter to the Danbury Baptists, and they're concerned because, you know, they're afraid that the political climate of the day is going to somehow inhibit their free exercise of religion. Jefferson responds by saying that when it comes to establishment, there needs to be a separation of church and state. Well, that was 1802. Fast forward 150 years approximately, 1947, we have Justice Hugo Black in this case called Everson versus Board of Education, Supreme Court Justice. And he is interpreting the First Amendment and the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. And he starts talking about the separation of church and state. He says the separation of church and state means that there should be no preference by the federal government and federal courts and government in general for one religion in favor of another, and so far so good, that's fine, and that the government should not establish a religion, still so far so good. But then in that same sentence, he used some very unfounded and frankly dangerous language. He said, nor favoritism for religion over irreligion. Did you catch that? He started by saying the First Amendment means, according to Jefferson and others who have interpreted it, that there shouldn't be establishment, there shouldn't be preference for one religion over another, and that there shouldn't be a preference for religion over irreligion. That was a fatal flaw in reasoning, and it was unfounded in history or original intent, including by Jefferson, that the First Amendment or that the Declaration and the guiding philosophy of our country ever contemplated that we would not favor religion over irreligion, over non-religion. That's where we have gone astray. You know, it was Adams who said that our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to any other. You know, the moment we start to discard the founding philosophy of the Declaration, that we exist as a result of a creator God, that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God guide good law and good policy. And the moment we start to believe statements like Hugo Black's, that government ought not to favor religion over irreligion, is the moment we start to separate us from our identity.
Those original philosophical statements that underpin the Constitution that exist
exactly.
In the Declaration.
The Constitution of the United States is one of only 17 constitutions in the world that exist still in its original form. All others are new since something like 1940. Its staying power, its strength, its purity, its truthfulness, its adherence to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God are truly extraordinary, are truly divine. And the moment that we start to separate ourselves and our laws from that guiding philosophy in the Declaration, which of course was implemented by the Constitution, is the moment that we put that first crack in the foundation of the greatness of America.
You're connected to the Cricket and Seagull Fireside Chat. Now more on the Declaration of Independence with Grant Beckwith.
As an educator, you've also seen how this has changed even the stories that are included in textbooks. Besides reminding everyone that on the 4th of July with parades and hot dogs and red, white, and blue, it might not hurt to read the Declaration of Independence reread and get a reminder, a little refresher on those undergirding philosophies. But I wonder if you'd share a couple of these stories, things that used to be even in school textbooks but have gone the way of all things, partly because of their religious content.
I'd be happy to. There's a great piece of history that used to be included in virtually all of America's textbooks, carried this story of Washington being protected by divine providence when he was the colonel of the Virginia militia.
So this is before the Revolutionary War.
Yes, the story of Washington predated the Revolutionary War. He was Colonel Washington of the Virginia Militia, not Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. So this is when he was younger. He was in his 20s. This is during the French and Indian War. The date is 1755. The British and the Americans are allies at this point in the French and Indian War. The Americans and the British are trying to get rid of the French and the Indians with respect to disputes over land. Washington is 23 years old, I think, and he's this wonderfully brilliant colonel, and he's asked by the British to help with a force of 2,300 British. Washington had something like 100 of his buckskin Virginia militia, and he was going to help the British get up to Fort Duquesne, which is now in Pittsburgh. 2,300 British, some Virginia militiamen, and Colonel Washington, General Braddock. They split the 2,300 up into two companies. So Washington had about 1,300 of these men, most of whom were British. They got about 7 miles out of Pittsburgh, of Fort Duquesne, and the Indians and the French had staged an ambush in a ravine. British, of course, were taught to march shoulder to shoulder. We see this kind of warfare and think today how just utterly ridiculous that is. But as they were marching through this ravine, the Indians, hiding behind trees and rocks and everything else, opened fire. There were 86 captains, colonels on horseback. Of course, in warfare, you try to shoot the leaders first. And of the 1,300 total in this company that Washington was leading, over 700 were killed in a two-hour time span in this ravine. So well over half. And of the 86 who were on horseback, all of them, except for one, Colonel Washington, had their horses shot out from under them or were killed. George Washington somehow escapes this thing alive, makes his way back to a fort in Maryland, and from there writes a letter to his mother and to his brother. And he says to them, you know, something to the effect of, by all dispensations of Providence, I have been protected beyond all expectation by the hand of God, and indicates that he had four bullet holes in his vest, none of which pierced his skin. And the story goes on because something like 15 years later, the Indian chief who was responsible for the massacre, for the ambush, finds Washington again. And the Indian chief says to George Washington, I have been seeking that general whom the Great Spirit protected in war. The Indian chief went on to explain that he shot personally 17 times, almost at point blank, at Washington, and could not fell him from his horse. So, and I've actually got, would you like to hear some of the words of this chief?
Sure.
Okay. So he says, I am a chief and ruler over my tribes. My influence extends to the waters of the Great Lakes and to the far Blue Mountains. I have traveled a long and weary path that I might see the young warrior of the great battle. It was on the day when the white man's blood mixed with the streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief, Washington. I called to my young men and said, mark yon tall and daring warrior. He is not of the redcoat tribe. He hath an Indian's wisdom, and his warriors fight as we do. Himself is alone exposed. Quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies. Our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for you, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier far than we shielded you. Seeing you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased to fire at you. I am old and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades, but ere I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen, the Great Spirit protects that man, and he pointed to Washington, and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. I am come to pay homage to the man who is the particular favorite of heaven and who can never die in battle. So, and this was in textbooks. This was in, because of course it's a wonderfully powerful example of the foreordination, if you will, not only of Washington, but of the place of America in world history by a supreme being. There were actually multiple accounts of this. There was another one by a young woman who was captured by the Shawnee Indians. She heard the Shawnee Indians talking about this chief who could not be shot off his horse at the same time. So this was, you know, 1770-ish, right around there. And she came back and told the whole story to her town. And there was even a preacher who shared this story about General Washington, the Shawnee Indians, saying they couldn't kill him. It wasn't the only time when Washington and others were literally protected by a divine hand. There was a British officer who told his story about seeing Washington and having the opportunity to kill Washington, and yet, for whatever reason, he lowered his rifle and could not do it. So, you know, books have been written about this. David Barton is one who does a great job of writing on this particular topic. It's sometimes referred to as the Bulletproof Washington story. You could find materials about that. But that's one. It's not carried in textbooks anymore, in part because it's so overtly religious. And that, of course, is a difficult story to tell in a textbook without getting into conversations that are sometimes uncomfortable in the prevailing classroom atmosphere. The other story is also about one of our founders, John Adams, the second president now, and when he was young as well, when he was in his 20s. John Adams went to Harvard University. Harvard was a seminary at the time. It had an overtly Christian and religious mission. This is the summer of 1756. So Adams was 20 years old at the time. He was really struggling about what to do with his future. At the time, he was discontent with himself, his present state of existence. He was prone to daydreaming. He felt like he constantly formed but never really executed good resolutions. And in his journal, he even wrote, oh, that I could wear out my mind every mean and base affectation, conquer my natural pride and conceit. So he was really uncomfortable with his state of existence at the time. He even vowed to quit chewing tobacco. It was one of those moments that we all go through where we're just really trying to purge from ourselves all unholy things and become a better person. Adams, being the prolific diarist that he was, and Abigail, his later wife, also so wonderful at writing in their diaries, and so we have so much wonderful material from them. He said in his journal, he said, so this was 1756, July 21st, he said, "I am resolved to rise with the sun and to study scriptures on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday mornings, and to study some Latin author the other three mornings. Noons and nights, I intend to read English authors. I will rouse up my mind and fix my attention. I will stand collected within myself and think upon what I read and what I see. I will strive with all my soul to be something more than persons who have had less advantages than myself." So he's in this time of real great introspection. And he had prepared himself spiritually for what was about to happen. And here's what happened. By late summer of 1756, he made up his mind to become a lawyer. So he decided to take an apprenticeship. He heard a sermon on Sunday that really inspired his new found direction of becoming someone who really fought for the revolution. It's been said that, you know, George Washington fought for the revolution, and there were others like Jefferson and Adams who thought for the revolution. Well, this was his newfound direction. He was going to dedicate himself to the cause of liberty. And so he was walking one summer night after he'd heard this sermon. He had this direction in life. And he was looking up into the stars. And he said in his journal that he gazed upon the amazing concave of heaven sprinkled with glittering stars. And as he looked heavenward, he saw this glorious show of nature, of God, in the heavens. These are his words. He felt that he was thrown into a kind of transport that caused him to ponder the gifts of God and the expressions of God's love. And after this personal revelation of sorts that he had, he said this, "But all the provisions that he has made," meaning God, "for the gratification of our senses are much inferior to the provision, the wonderful provision that he has made for the gratification of our nobler powers of intelligence and reason. He has given us reason to find out truth and the real design and the true end of our existence." And it's this kind of language sometimes that is taken out of context, that is taken sometimes as meaning that the founding fathers were children of the Enlightenment, the age of reason, and that it was only reason that they believed led to the revolution, the Declaration, the Constitution. But the whole context of that journal entry was revelation. The whole context of that journal entry was revelation. He believed it. Washington believed in divine providence protection. That is the spirit of our identity and our founding. And it is one that is born in the Judeo-Christian school of thought. So those are some stories we don't read about anymore. Whenever we talk about America's founding, especially when it is discussed in intellectual circles, there's always a camp that proclaims the founders to be deist, which is a nice way of saying that they didn't believe in a personal God that governed in the personal affairs of man. And there's a camp that tries to make that argument based on the fact that the founders did not use what we view as, you know, modern Christians, for example, to be Christian language. You know, how many times did you hear George Washington stand up and actually use the word Jesus or Christ? Not that many in public speeches. He did, but not often. He usually used the language of the predominantly Anglican language of Providence. There's a great book written by Michael Novak about Washington and Washington's God. There's an appendix that essentially compiles all the references to God that Washington used, or at least as many as there were in things like the inaugural, his farewell address, the Thanksgiving address that he gave. And I love looking at this appendix because, you know, there's these just beautiful descriptions of God. Let me give you some examples. "That being who is powerful to save and in whose hands is the fate of nations. The benign parent of the human race, creator, divine author of our blessed religion, giver of life, grand architect of the universe, great author of the universe, Jehovah." That was used in one of his public speeches. Or letters. Jesus Christ. See, he did use the words, not quite as often as some of the less overtly Christian language that we're familiar with, but it wasn't the manner of speaking in the Christian parishes of the day. Washington was a parishioner. He was a vestryman in his church at the time. He was a great Christian, but clearly there was some disillusionment on the part of not just Washington, but Jefferson and Franklin and some others. There was some disillusionment about the organized religion of the day. But Joseph Smith had the same disillusionment at the same time, roughly, plus or minus 20 years, right? But that doesn't mean that Joseph was not a Christian, or that George Washington was not a Christian, or that Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian. And this concept of deism and deist, and that word defined is really a belief in a supreme being, that Earth and the universe was created by a supreme being and then left to evolve on its own. That's not what the founders were. You cannot read their writings, public or private, and believe that they felt that God did not intervene in the personal affairs of man, that he did not govern man's not only intimate but public affairs. I wanted to say that, too, because I recognize that there's a certain intellectual contingent out there that feels like it's a non-starter to say that we as a nation were founded upon Judeo-Christian ideals and that the founders themselves were Christians. I would respond quite strongly to that and argue quite strongly against that argument.
Grant Beckwith, principal of the American Heritage School, thank you for reminding us of those basic principles and for these stories that I've never heard before, and I'm sure many others have not. Thanks for making time.
You're welcome. Glad to help.
This is Bob Anderson. Until next time, keep your powder dry. That's this week on Bob's Radio Journal. Thanks for listening.